Greetings, Popdose fans and listeners, and welcome to the fourth installment of Platters That Matter. I'm Chris Holmes, a.k.a. the man in the gray flannel suit, and joining me, as always, is the ever-lovable D.W. Dunphy. In this episode, we're going to talk about Queen II, released in March of 1974. It was, as you might guess, the sophomore album from Queen, and stands as one of the band's most loved records. A small technical note before we begin. This podcast was actually recorded in July, but you're only hearing it now because I am, in fact, an incredibly lazy bastard. Not that any of that makes a difference, but I felt I should come clean just the same. So, with that out of the way, let's talk Queen II. Okay, DW, let's start off with you as we normally do. Let's get your thoughts on Queen the Second.
Okay, well, part of the thing about Queen the Second is this is the point in their career where they actually become Queen. And what I mean by that is all the things that we've come to recognize as Queen, at least from this time period. You have, in a much more prominent way, the multi-tracking. You have the wilder guitar sound out of Brian May. You've got Freddie Mercury coming into his own. But the thing is that when you're listening to this album, it is very much two sides at one point, because literally side white is the first five songs, side black is the rest of the album. One side is mostly by Brian May, with Freddie Mercury taking the other side, and the only difference is that at the end of side one you have a Roger Taylor song. We'll get into that in a moment. But this is the point where the Queen that we know from A Day at the Races, A Night at the Opera, this is where that truly begins in full.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we really get into it, I'm going to ask you to pick a side right now, and then when we get finished dissecting these songs to death, we'll see if you have the same opinion. So give me a pick, white or black.
For me, I'm thinking white.
Yeah.
I'm thinking white, even though side black is great, but it's bonkers. That's the best way I can describe it. And we'll get into the reason why I'm sort of siding with side white as we go along, but I'm going to go with side white to start with.
I think I'd be inclined to agree, but let's go ahead and get started. So side white kicks off with an instrumental just over a minute in length called Procession, which takes the form of a funeral march type arrangement, not unlike sounds that Brian May would explore quite often on future albums. It's basically just multi-tracked guitars, one on top of another, and then at the end transitions into track two. Do we have anything to say about Procession other than the fact that it exists?
About all I can say about it is that you can definitely hear that this is the person that would eventually record the wedding march for the Flash Gordon soundtrack.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, now that I think about it, I don't mean to give it short shrift. It does serve it's an excellent table setter for what is a very, very dense three songs to follow. I suspect that if they kicked right into track two, it would have been a lot more jarring.
Father to son, hear the word that I song to song. And the voice is so clear.
It would have, especially because track two, at least in my mind, and you could deny this or say I'm crazy after you hear this, but I believe that the second song, Father to Son, really shows the influences that helped make Queen. And the reason why I say that is because when we think of Queen, we think of the band as this singular thing. They just arrived out of nowhere. They sounded that way. But if you listen to Father to Son, at least with my ears, it sounds like it starts with The Who. In the middle, it becomes the Beach Boys, almost. And in the end, I swear, I'm hearing strains of Hey Jude. So you've got three major influences coming from the 60s, at least I believe, that is influencing this song. And that's really, I believe, one of the strengths of Brian May, is that he's able to synthesize all that stuff into something that eventually will become the band's signature sound.
You know, now that you mention that, I never really associated The Who with this song, but now that I'm thinking about it, the first part of it really would fit on, say, Quadrophenia, which was yet to come at this point.
Quadrophenia or the opening overture of Tommy.
Yeah.
Because that's like one of the first things is like, these people listen to Tommy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, they were British and they were of record buying age in the 60s, so who wouldn't have?
And the thing that I think a lot of people tend to forget is also, Queen is not that far removed from these people. It was only, 5 or 6 years out from the breakup of the Beatles. The Beach Boys were still going, albeit Brian Wilson was off in the distance. The Who was about to come into one of their biggest commercial peaks. So they are influences, but they are also contemporaries in many ways. So it's not that unusual.
Yeah, I think I've read an interview with either May or Roger Taylor talking about some of their influences, contemporary influences, one of which was The Who, and I believe another one was Led Zeppelin, to nobody's surprise. I can't think of a band that played guitar rock in that decade that wasn't influenced by Zeppelin in some way.
Right. Although the way they come about it, the way it comes out of them was much different, because Queen, you know, every now and then you'll get sort of that hard blues sound, but they took the same seeds and went off in divergent ways.
I think if I had to make a comparison of early Queen, and, well, early Queen, we're really only talking about their first two albums, because by the time they got to Sheer Heart Attack, they had really changed quite drastically. But those first two albums, I would say they had the flair, the creativity, and the artfulness of early Genesis with the muscle of The Who.
Yeah, I'd definitely go with that. And ambition. Because as you said, with the Genesis aside, this is a band that really had an idea of what they wanted to do outside of the norms. I mean, not to jump the gun too much, but Side Black is essentially, in an album side, a suite that they would boil down into Bohemian Rhapsody in many ways. They were following their own prog influences all the way up to and including the Day and Night albums.
Yeah. So speaking of track two, which we have been for a while now, Father to Son, the second Brian May track from Side White, transitions in directly from Procession and basically sounds very much like the music on the first Queen album, but you can tell right away, I mean, I wasn't listening to this when it came out, but you could tell that they had taken the ideas and the sounds of the first album and just expanded them exponentially, and that was partially due to a lot more freedom they had from the record company, a lot more recording time in the studio, even though the whole album took about a month to record. You could tell that they really had learned a lot in that short period, and they were ready to start more satisfactorily fleshing out their creative ideas in the studio.
And from some of the things I read, there is sort of this backstory that they were not happy with their studio experience during the first album, and so they really took it upon themselves to demand we have ideas, we're taking it in this direction, and they really demanded their freedom to a certain extent to stay in there and do it until they got it the way they wanted it. Now, clearly, things were different back in the early 70s, where you were expected to put out possibly two albums a year. You had to keep your name out there. You did that through releasing albums. But this was sort of a period of time where you had all these people who were saying, you know, we're going to be in the studio. We're going to make it worth every minute. And it definitely comes out. It has to.
I think Queen benefited from a couple things. One, not to compare them directly to the Beatles, but I think the Beatles showed that you could have a commercially successful album while still spending tons of time in the studio meticulously poring over tracks. And I think the second is you probably had a more friendly climate in the UK for this type of music. This was, of course, the golden age of prog. You know, Dark Side of the Moon had come out. A couple of Yes's best albums have come out. We already mentioned Genesis was on their way up. And so, you know, I think that this was really the golden age in the 70s of the studio as recording instrument.
That and the fact that they had a producer that was amenable to really working it, and that was Roy Thomas Baker.
Yep.
He has a credits list as long as my arm. You know, you have the earliest of the Steve Perry Journey albums. You have, obviously, Queen. You have The Cars. Mm-hmm. And it's a very dense sound. He tends to turn down the brightness a little bit. When he wants to punch things up, you'll have a treble coming in, but it's mostly in mid-range, and he gets a lot of surprise out of you, because when you're hearing it, it's very thick, and it's very mid-range as far as that goes, and then every now and then you hit these treble hits, and it's shocking, but it works.
So we move from Father and Son to probably my favorite song. No, I take that back. Let me see. Yeah, my favorite song from Side White, White Queen.
The White Queen walks and the night grows pale. Stars of lovingness in the air.
One of the early examples of Brian May as a top-rate songwriter took his inspiration from reading a book called The White Goddess, which I know nothing about other than it has a pretty deep exploration of the mythic underpinnings of modern poetry or some such jazz. Like I said, Artie. This is a song that I think really, you know, I've talked before, I think in some of our other podcasts, about how an album cover can really influence your perception of the music on that album and sort of create the mood for it. And on the Queen 2 album cover, we have that really dark photo taken by Mick Rock of the band. And I think that White Queen really plays into that kind of dark, not dark in a sinister way, but that moody, dense. This is an album that I used to listen to all the time with the lights off, not in any kind of creepy way, but I just felt like it really perfected the mood that this album evoked. And in White Queen, you've got those, you've got Roger Taylor playing the cymbals with the mallets to get that sort of orchestral effect. It's a very slow-moving piece, but in no way plodding, and it's full of gorgeous atmosphere, and it really is, for me, the highlight of the first side.
I like that it doesn't lean heavily on the hard rock sound. It gets in there. It gets in there more toward the end, but it really is a gradual build to the heavy crescendo, which would be really difficult to take if it was a super heavy song, because when we get into Side Black, that's what we're talking about. So this is really a prelude to what you're going to find later on. The one thing that I'm curious about is who brought what first, because as I said when we opened it up, the first side is mostly written by Brian May, and the second side is completely written by Freddie Mercury. So I'm wondering who brought in White Queen and said, let's have Black Queen, or whether it was, I'm doing Black Queen and you should consider doing White Queen. I'm wondering exactly how that worked out.
Well, according to my copious research on Wikipedia, March of the Black Queen was actually composed the year before. So Queen went into the studio for this album in the spring of 74. So I would say it's a safe bet that the Black Queen came first. But then again, like I said, it's named directly after that book. So, you know, probably one of those wonderful convergences of fate that the really great bands are blessed with in the universe.
And then from there, we're going to move on to the next song, which you probably won't agree with me on this, but Someday One Day is the last of the Brian May songs. And for me, for some reason, I'm hearing a little bit of the Moody Blues. I don't know why, but especially toward the end, I'm getting the feeling like this could have been one of those early 70s Moody Blues kinds of songs.
Can't refute your point one way or another, because other than about three or four songs in the Moody Blues, I'm a complete ignoramus when it comes to that band.
So, okay.
But if you say so, we'll go with that. This is the first Queen studio song, if memory serves, where Brian took all the lead vocals.
Yes.
I think it shows a little bit, because there's an unusual amount of wavering in his voice. He was never the most assured lead singer in the world, a perfectly fine voice, but I'm guessing that unless he was drunk, he was probably nervous as hell when he recorded this. It's not a problem. It doesn't drag down the song. It's just something that, as a longtime fan, having heard the song dozens and dozens of times, you tend to notice, you know, hey, he's quivering a little more than usual, but I think it also goes into, it kind of benefits the song in a way as well.
It benefits the song, but one of the difficult things is if you are the lead singer and you have a certain amount of charisma or whatever, but you come off sort of on a rough side, that's fine. If you are the secondary lead singer, ostensibly, and your lead singer is Freddie Mercury, that is a difficult, that's a difficult job to take. So he must have felt very, very attached to this song to want it to be his voice on it.
You know, I liken this once again to the situation with The Who, where on most of their songs, being as powerful as they are, Roger Daltrey is the perfect singer for them. But when you want that really tender, sensitive, not that Freddie was not capable of it, he certainly had a ton more nuance than Roger Daltrey had on his best day, but something about the timbre of Pete Townsend's voice on the songs that he sings sounds kind of similar to the Brian May vocal effect. It's got that slightly thin, reedy, but not nasally or annoying. It ends up sounding a little less assured, but a lot more earnest, particularly on the more romantic songs like Someday One Day is.
Yeah. And then we go into probably the oddest, at least for me, the oddest song on the album, simply because it doesn't fit into any of the preconceptions that have already been here. So we've sort of gone into this side white, side black, black queen, white queen. We get The Loser in the End, which is a contribution from Roger Taylor, and can be summed up as, Sonny, you better respect your mom, and mom, you better not be such a pill.
Mama's got a problem, she don't know what to say. The little baby boy is just left home today. She's got to be the loser in the end. She's got to be the loser in the end. Misuse her, and you lose her as a friend. She's mom on whom you can always depend.
I like the songs that ring. Sorry, Roger Taylor.
Oops, Freudian slip.
Roger Taylor provides to the Queen albums. You know, it's, I don't know if it's in spite of this song that I like The White Side more or because of it, but one of the things I've always enjoyed about Roger Taylor's Queen songs is that they tend to let a little air out of the balloon and keep their albums from becoming too pompous and overblown. You know, Roger, you know, I really have no interest in a complete album of the works of Roger Taylor, but I think it's a great antidote to the artier aspirations of the band. You know, he's kind of, or at least he comes across as this real, you know, blue collar, you know, go down to the pub and get pissed type.
Right. He's kind of a bloke.
Yeah. Yeah. He's absolutely a bloke, you know, and how can you not love a song that's entire point is, you know, why don't you give your mom a cold in, huh?
Yeah. And I totally agree with your point because, For an album like, say, News of the World, with the songs that's on there, especially when you have songs like All Dead, All Dead, and then you have Roger Taylor bringing in I'm in Love with My Car. So he does act as a leavener. He definitely does.
Yeah, and, you know, I like Roger Taylor. I love his contributions to the band. Although I think you had a bit of a goof. Did you say that I'm in Love with My Car was off News of the World? That's Night at the Opera.
That's Night at the Opera. Damn.
Yeah.
You're right.
News of the World was, he did Sheer Heart Attack, I believe.
That's
you know what? That was Freddie Mercury.
No, that was Freddie Mercury and Brian May did a part of that. Although,
okay.
Roger Taylor did backups.
Yeah. So, I mean, Roger, we're getting a song like this. We're getting, Tenement Funster from Sheer Heart Attack. You get more of that jazz. You know, Prime Jive off of The Game. I really like Roger Taylor's songs in the context of Queen's albums, and I think this is, you know, I'll give some love to this one as well, even though it comes after a particularly ambitious stretch of music from the band.
Yeah. And to clarify, you're absolutely right about I'm in Love with My Car being on there. Part of the problem with my senile brain is that I used to have the 45 of We Are the Champions, We Will Rock You. And for some reason on the B-side of the one that I had, it might have been one of those greatest hits or one of those gold label things that Elektra used to do. Mm. On the other side was I'm in Love with My Car, so I'm just slipping a disc.
I'm an idiot. It comes from wearing those big thick jackets in 90-degree heat.
Well, you know, if you can't cook your brain, what can you cook?
Yeah, I guess so. All right, so we move on. We flip the record and put the needle back on for Cy Black. Ooh, black.
And holy crap. Holy crap. You turn this on and it's like, did I put the needle on the wrong side of the album?
Yeah.
What's going on here?
Wherein Freddie Mercury loses his shit and Queen turns into Led Zeppelin dropping acid.
Now once upon a time, an old man told me a fable. When the farmer is
Have the first song off the side, Ogre Battle, which was actually written during the sessions or before the sessions for the first album, but perhaps sensing that it was completely batshit and that they did not have the time or the budget to do it right for the first album, they held on and released it for the second album. And from the backwards tape effect with the gong and the vocals to the battle effects, the guitar created battle effects and the screaming, the piercing wailing in the middle, you know, this is about as gonzo as Queen gets, I think.
It is, but I'll tell you what, it'll wake you up in the morning.
Yeah.
So I was actually listening to this on the way home a couple weeks ago, and all right, this album is 40 something years old now.
Jeez.
And still, I know it's scary, but then still I've got the windows down. People are looking at me like, what the hell are you listening to? It still has that visceral effect of just making everybody who hears it just stand up and take serious notice. And then you read the lyrics and it's like, okay, it's an ogre battle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a metaphor. He's talking about an ogre battle.
I have to say this is one aspect in which the song is a bit of a letdown. I find the lyrics just, I don't know.
Yeah.
A little too goofy, a little too out there. I don't know. I don't really think about it too much. I mean, like I said, it is called Ogre Battle. There's no false advertising here. One thing I did think about actually today while I was preparing my mental notes for this show is, not more than a year after this album came out, a then fairly obscure trio from Canada released an album called Fly By Night, had a song on there called By Tower and the Snow Dog, which perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, had a battle scene in the middle of the song replicated with, recreated with guitar effects. And the inquisitive part of my brain wonders, were Rush Queen fans, had they heard Ogre Battle and decided that's something they wanted to do? Or again, was that just one of those things that seemed to be floating out in the air in the early to mid 70s?
That's a very hard question to answer, simply because if we are going to call Queen 2 what it is, it's essentially a prog rock album. These are ideas that have been in the prog rock universe and have been generally derided in the prog rock universe, the whole thing with fantasy elements. So who knows? They could be floating on the same cloud, or maybe one did influence the other. You would probably have to ask Neil Peart.
Yeah,
he's the only man who would know.
It's probably unlikely, mostly due to the fact that the second album in America only got to, I think, the 50s on the chart, probably did less well in Canada. So, it seems fairly unlikely. There was no YouTube back then where you could hear any song from anywhere around the world. I think it might be worth somebody's time, not mine, to do an exploration of the use of guitars and other electronic instruments to recreate battle scenes in music. Literal battle scenes.
Right.
So, there you go. There's my academic aside for the show.
High honors to you, sir.
Well met. All right. So, going from the Ogre Battle to a song based off a painting. Man, these guys were already... Holy crap. The Fairy Feller's Masterstroke. Probably the song that when I would sing this album, sitting in the dark... again, not creepy. Listening to this album, I had more fun singing than anything else, just because it is such an exercise in breathing techniques to get all of those lyrics out in the time allotted.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it is the height of a tongue twister. I would really, really like to know how many takes it took Freddie Mercury to spit this one out. If it was only like one or two takes, if I was wearing a hat, it'd be off for him right now. But it's a tough song. It really is. Having said that, it's, I don't know what kind of time period I would place it in. I mean, it's clearly a rock album, but it's influenced by almost like a 16th century feel, if that makes any sense.
Well, you're just probably because of the harpsichord, you're thinking that, right?
Either that or I've just got, you know, Sting on the brain and it's all them lutes in my head.
Oh, and castanets. Roy Thomas Baker on the castanets, everybody.
Put up your lighters. It's Roy Thomas Baker.
Castanet solo.
Yes. And then comes, believe it or not, one of my favorite songs on the album. And it's also one of the shortest on the album. But Nevermore is Mercury at his vocal finest. One of his absolute beautiful moments. And I think that it's a nice breather on this album, that on this side, which up to this point is very hyperbolic. And this is just sort of a breath before we get into the next one, which is the all out mess.
Yeah. I think the great strength of this album, other than the songs, is one that we've talked about before on other shows, in that there is a real purposeful sense of pacing and song placement and dynamics. And they could have gone balls out for 40 minutes and just thrown everything they had at the wall, but I think they instinctively knew to hold back a little bit, pace themselves a little bit, and put in songs like Nevermore and even a song like Loser in the End. Because if you had wall-to-wall, you know, March of the
Psychosis.
Black Queen or Ogre Battle, I mean, 40 minutes of Ogre Battle, I don't care how much of a fan of a band you are, that gets grating in a big hurry. And I really,
yeah.
You know, and especially with as bonkers as Freddie's songs are on this side, he needed more of that tonic than I think Brian did on his side.
That's true, and it's also, I think that we are getting there again, at least for those bands and artists that are interested in the album as a form, the idea that you have to create a pace, and every now and then you have to slow it down, every now and then you have to bring it back, because if it was just front-loaded, the first five songs are going to rip your head off, and then you're just exhausted for the rest, or they just keep on going. It's not a pleasant experience. And I think that now that vinyl is coming back, and it's back to 40 minutes, 45 minutes being a window, and people are thinking about, all right, 10 good songs, as opposed to 13 songs with half of it being filler, I'm hoping that those interested in the album experience are going back to that.
I couldn't agree more, my friend. And so, we come to arguably the centerpiece of Queen 2, March of the Black Queen. What a baby singing in a little pretty light. Little animal kiss, rain on the dead of night. Here comes the Black Queen, walking in the pine. Fight for the Black Queen, marching single file.
Oh,
baby, you can be my honey too.
I came to the Queen 2 album. I worked backwards in Queen's discography, just to give a little bit of background here. I'm pretty certain my first Queen album was either The Game or that original Greatest Hits album they had that I think was since deleted from the catalog, which fans of the time will know because it had the version of Flash with the movie dialogue in it. So as I got older, I started making my way backwards, which is, I think, not an uncommon thing for people just getting into a band with a pretty deep discography for the first time. And so I came to Night at the Opera first, before Queen 2. As soon as I heard March of the Black Queen, I thought, oh, look, it's another version of Bohemian Rhapsody, when in fact, Bohemian Rhapsody is really just a refinement of March of the Black Queen.
Right. It's definitely, and I think it's one of those things that a lot of people can get caught up with, because that is one of those albums that people do end up with first. Day at the Races, A Night at the Opera, maybe Jazz, definitely The Game, simply because that has Another One Bites the Dust. And then people will go into the larger discography, and you do get sort of that whole Kurt Vonnegut thing of slipping through time, and you start thinking about the older stuff as the newer stuff. And I've experienced that with other bands as well, and then you sort of catch yourself up and go, oh no, wait, this one came first, so these ideas really were always there. We're just working them out and getting them, polishing them up and making them better as we go along.
Yeah, and I think one of the really fun things about listening to the really good bands that do progress creatively in their career is going back and piecing together, and you can pick out little snippets of songs that are developed more fully on subsequent albums. And I mean, this one is a little more explicit. It's got a very similar structure. I mean, it's not quite as ambitious. It's not quite as theatrical, and it doesn't have that fantastic vocal bridge. But nevertheless, for somebody who has not heard the song, listen to the whole thing, and you know, it's definitely an older brother. You know, Bohemian Rhapsody V1. But that being said, it's probably not as balls out aggressive and purposefully off-putting as Ogre Battle, but it is high on ambition and structure. And you know, I would listen to arguments for this being the best song on the Black side.
Right. And if you look at the lyrics, you have to understand that as much as the White Queen was very literal in its fantasy, the Black Queen, because perhaps it's Freddie Mercury, is laden with a sense of metaphor. Let's just say that if there was going to be any influence on here, maybe it's Lou Reed, because as you're reading the lyrics, the Black Queen is a fetish, essentially.
Right.
That's really sort of the crux of this, is that it's a guy falling for a fetish. So.
Yeah, but, you know, put in such a flowery, I mean, Freddie has such a way with words, particularly back in the 70s, that, I mean, you could have passed this off in, you know, a high school poetry class, not that I'm calling it high school grade, but you could have turned this in and said, you know, well, I wrote this poem, and, you know, you would have gotten high honors for it, because it's so evocative, and it's so vivid in its imagery, and a lot of great alliteration. It's another really satisfying song to sing along to, because the words just roll perfectly off the tongue. It really is a lyrically complete song.
And if I was the teacher in that class, I would still give the student an A, even though I would know that he stole it from somebody else, simply because when I was in school, all my friends used to try to pass off War Pigs as theirs, and it's like, come on, work a little harder, would you please?
I didn't even bother. I was the one who got stared at by bringing Alexander the Great by Iron Maiden into my history class. And I actually convinced the teacher, who I realize now was trying to fill 180 days of lessons, and got him to play this song in front of the whole class.
I would have loved to have been in that class. Let's move on to the next one, because again, when I'm talking about Queen sort of showing their influences, this is not as influenced as perhaps Brian May's side and his songs, but for me, Funny How Love is essentially what Queen would sound like if Phil Spector were somehow involved. Got sort of that wall of sound, and you have that beat, boom, 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 cha, boom, 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 cha. It's mm-hmm. very much a Ronettes kind of thing happening there.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. I just need to state for the record that this is probably my least favorite song on the album, even less than Roger's song, and I'm not really counting Procession, but I don't know. Something about this feels like a bit of a letdown. But I suppose it's for the best. It's, if you end with a song like March of the Black Queen, or you end with that song in particular, it's kind of like being on a really, really nasty roller coaster, and then at the end, it just stops short at 1G. And I feel like you kind of need the two songs that end that album to kind of re-enter the atmosphere from where you were.
I actually think this probably would have worked better on side one, simply because it doesn't fit into the narrative. This is a perfectly nice love pop song kind of thing. It doesn't fit into the narrative. We've already gone into all these fantasy elements, all this nastiness and ogre battles and things like that. And Funny How Love is very straightforward, essentially.
Yeah, it's probably that one song on the album that I think holds it back from perfection, and is one that I, maybe 3 or 4 out of every time, 10 times I listen to the album, I just skip right over it. And when I do, I skip over to the final song, and I can't believe that we're only at the 40-minute mark here. Seven Seas of Rye, which had its first appearance in truncated, slower form on the first Queen album. A bizarre artistic decision, if you ask me. I thought it was very strange that, hey, we have a song that's only half finished, so we're going to play 30 seconds of it for you on our album. And just somebody actually greenlit that decision.
Well, again, this is some of the things that I read and I can't fully verify, but I have read that the record label at the time was saying, it's going to be awfully difficult to release any of these other songs as singles, simply because most of them do not kick in hard. You can't grab people from the start, and the ones that do kick in hard are just a little too crazy for pop radio. We're not going to be able to float this over. So I would think that maybe Seven Seas Arise, because it has that just 70s rock, it just right jumps in, you know, and you're into it. There's not a lot of preceding, slow build-up. So I'm saying it was probably a business decision. They said, we can really just take this and rock with it, and that's probably why it's there. I think it would have been more effective had maybe, like I said, Funny How Love Is was on side one, and this immediately followed Black Queen. But then again, that would break up the whole idea of Brian May's side and Freddie Mercury's side, so it's sort of a challenge to figure out where they were thinking on that, but whatever.
I think it's a fun, rollicking song, and again, it's a good way to end the album where it's not too dour and quiet, but, you know, and it rocks enough that you don't feel like it's a complete 180 creatively. But it's also a really good standalone song. Although, again, perhaps showing my age a little bit, this is one album in our little podcast series where I do not own the vinyl. So the first version of this album that I had was the Hollywood Records reissue from the 90s, from the 30th, no. So when would this have been? The 20th anniversary of the band. So the one with all those awful remixes at the end, I don't know if you ever picked up any of those.
Yeah.
Oof, that was dark, man. However, so in my mind, this album actually ends with what was a B-side, See What a Fool I've Been. Because I would always just listen, go right from Seven Seas into See What a Fool I've Been. And it really didn't feel like a drastic shift, a tonal shift. It was a much better flow, and it let the last couple songs feel less like standouts and more like the next creative phase of the album.
What a fool I've been. Oh Lord, cute and cruel. What a fool I've been. Yes, I did. Too much. Didn't leave me no letter. Didn't leave no one. You naughty thing, you. Sailor boy, ciao, right now. Take it. I'm a little dog, ain't too hungry. No, no. He just kept on barking. The vicious thing.
See, I have not heard that song. I've got the my CD version is just the original album track list. So I'm at a loss.
Well, we were talking before about some of that blues sound creeping into some of the music on the album. This is pretty much, you know, like Zeppelin was on the first album in terms of just, hey, here's a hard rock version of the blues. That's kind of what See What a Fool I've Been is. Although it's, you know, with Freddie, it's got a little more of that, you know, torch song vocal thing. I think at one point he utters the line, see you later, sailor boy, or something like that. So, you know, he puts on his Marlene Dietrich persona. But it's a pretty straight-ahead blues rock tune. But it's fun. And it's got some excellent drumming from Roger Taylor. So I'll throw a clip up when I edit this all together. And in the meantime, as soon as we're done, you know, get the to iTunes or to YouTube and check it out.
I will do that.
All right, so we've come to the conclusion of our return trip down the vinyl memory lane. Any closing thoughts on Queen 2?
Well, a couple things. The first thing, especially with the those first Queen albums, is they always used to have a little tag in the liner notes. They were always very proud of the fact that they didn't use synthesizers.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, actually. Thank you for bringing it up.
And that change, what would have been the big change on that one?
The game
would have been it, because since that open up, play the game.
Yep. And that I'm pretty sure that predated Flash Gordon, which is an extremely synth heavy album.
Yeah. But having said that, I own most of the Queen albums. There's only a couple of them I don't have. And on every one of them, you get at least one or two songs that bring it all right back. Even the last album, Innuendo, has a couple songs. It's like, yeah, that's the band I remember. Mm-hmm. Even as they were moving to something else. Right. And even as one of the best songs on that album is the mellowest thing they probably ever done, which, you know, These Are the Days of Our Lives, which is a song I love. Mm-hmm. But saying that, what I'm trying to say is that here's a band that, in my mind, should stop. And I know people are going to say, oh my God, how can you say that? And I'm saying that the band that I love can no longer exist, no matter how much a person might like Paul Rodgers. He doesn't fit as the lead singer of Queen. No matter how much people would like what's his face from American Idol? What's
Adam Lambert?
Adam Lambert. It should be a different band because, and I don't want to get precious about it, but the fact is that they built up such an amazing body of work, and it just feels wrong to me. And I think that if you grew up with things like this, like Queen 2 and all those albums all the way up, it's just something you don't want to see that tarnished, even though everyone says Adam Lambert is a good performer and a good vocalist, and that's fine. They can do something else, but I just get so edgy when someone says Queen with Adam Lambert. It's like, no, it's not.
You know, I tend to be really inconsistent when it comes to whether or not I will accept an alternative version of a band, especially one that's been around for a long time. And there's really no rhyme or reason as to why, if one band tries to move on from a lead singer, it's cool, but in other cases, it's not. But I think we can all see the last several years of Queen activity for what it is, and it's basically a money grab. You know, Brian May and Roger Taylor know that if they try to book Wembley Stadium going as, you know, Taylor and May, you know, they'd be lucky to, you know, get enough people to fill the field. But, you know, throw that Queen name out there, which has earned so much goodwill, at least around the non-U.S. portions of the world, and, you know, you're going to fill a stadium because, people miss seeing the band live so much that, for some reason, they're willing to overlook the fact that the most important component of the band has been gone for over 20 years. And, you know, I think I'm too old to care about such a thing anymore, and really being a Kiss fan, if I'm not used to, quasi-tribute bands going out on tour, then, you know, I would be getting so angry I could never leave the house. But right. Yeah, in theory, I would agree with you. You know, Queen died when Freddie died, and I think John Deacon acknowledges as much, even though he may not have said anything. The fact that he retired from performing,
right.
I think,
right,
speaks volumes.
His absence pretty much says everything that needs to be said about it. It's just like, I don't even think it's Queen anymore, so...
Yeah. Going back to what you said before about the no synthesizer tag, I was going to bring that up because it was a really strange sort of badge of honor for certain bands in the 70s and 80s to put right in the liner notes... And for those under the age of, say, 30, the liner notes are, no, to put, you know, no synthesizers were used in the creation of this album. And I remember back to the mid-80s and, you know, so Iron Maiden, I mentioned before, being one of my three favorite bands of all time. So I have one of their home videos on VHS, and there's footage of them touring Europe, and I remember to this day, so this would have been on the tour for Peace of Mind, for those who are familiar with the bands, or it was a Peace of Mind or Power Slave. So we're talking like the 83 to 84 time frame. And they're at some kind of club, like in Poland or somewhere. And one of the fans comes up and asks Bruce Dickinson, the lead singer, why doesn't Iron Maiden use synthesizers in their records? And Bruce's response was, you can't have heavy metal with synthesizers, to bust out my shitty English accent again. Fast forward one album after Power Slave, and you've got Somewhere in Time, which has wall-to-wall synthesizers. But it was really like a point of honor, I guess, among these rock bands that synthesizers were viewed with such disdain. And I'm not sure why, but I'm curious to know what other bands, you know, another research project for somebody who has way too much free time on their hands, you know, other bands that put similar disclaimers in their records about, you know, no synthesizers sullying the pure rockness of this music.
I think a lot of it was just the times. In the 80s, synth was everywhere, and you were either on board or you were an old fart band, and I guess a lot of these bands just didn't feel like being old fart bands, or they just didn't feel it was marketable. Either way, if the band was viable, if they were able to produce something of quality, there was a lot of things that, even with the synthesizers, didn't bother me. And then there are a lot of things that I would hear it and I would go, oh, wow, they're really trying to pad that thing up, aren't they? It all comes down to, do you have the talent or do you not? Do you understand arrangement or do you not? And like I said before, on every Queen album, even on the much derided Hot Space, you had Under Pressure and Las Palabras de Amor, which are two fantastic songs in my mind, and stand for everything that Queen has ever been or will be, I guess. And the synthesizers were just a part of the whole. Body Language, I can live without.
Or the steaming pile known as Backchat.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. You stymied me. Now that I've had to think about Hot Space, my synapses are misfiring.
I've made you speechless. My job here is done.
I completely forgot how I was going to end this goddamn thing. All right. So, I think that's the end. I've run out of things to say. How about you?
I had barely any ability to say anything already, as you can tell.
I know what I was going to ask. What do you think the 2013 equivalent on an album liner notes, which again are the text that what would the 2013 equivalent be of no synthesizers used in this album, since clearly that is not a taboo thing anymore?
No guitars used on this album.
Yeah. No unprocessed vocals.
No feature featuring this person or that person dropping the chorus.
No Pro Tools, no auto-tune. I heard auto-tune in a fucking Queendrake song, man. I wanted to barf. that new Queendrake, the one without Jeff Tate. We talked about this at the Ben Folds 5 show. God, when I heard that, my balls crawled back in my abdomen.
You know, I've been one of those people that have been dragging on about the two different Queendrake, and I hate to say it because Jeff Tate has been a tool bag to his fans and he's been a tool bag to his band. And he has put out a lot of lousy albums over the years. But I have to say that I think Queensryche needs Jeff Tate and Jeff Tate needs Queensryche, and they both need to knock it the hell off.
Maybe they should have hired Paul Rodgers.
Well, I hear that he is unemployed right now, so hey, why not? It's a deal.
Yeah, awesome. I can't wait for it, man.
Yes, I'm so excited. We can go to the Paul Rodgers PNC Art Center tour where he gets to be with every band that needs a fill-in.
I think Queendrake with Paul Rodgers would be lucky to fill the Stone Pony.
Oh, for all you people that don't understand what the Stone Pony is,
sorry.
Look at your garden shed.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're now betraying our New Jersey heritage.
And our love of tiny, tiny buildings.
Yeah. All right, well, now I'm thoroughly depressed, so I'm going to hit stop on this recording, and then we'll have to pick this up again with some other album. So thanks again for joining me, and sorry everyone who actually cares about the long delay, but, you know, real life tends to get in the way of these things. We'll try not to go so long without the next before the next podcast, but I can offer no guarantees.
But we do want to put something out there. We want to thank everybody who has been checking out the podcast up to this point.
Yes.
And have been earnestly asking us when it comes back, because you don't understand how lonely it is without your approval. We love you, and we want you to continue listening to Platters That Matter podcasts.
Yep, and I will just say that no synthesizers were used in the making of this podcast. And
Well, speak for yourself.
Yeah, I'm going to add some later on.